And it's Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Laura Houston. And I am so honored and blessed to have Michael Brown back again. Now, I know you're going away on hiatus, so we're actually going to air this again for those who don't get to listen to it today in October, on October 2nd. And we are going to be talking today about The Presence Process, which is your first book. And I have to say, what an amazing book. So I am so excited about talking with you all about this because I've been really, I've just delved really deep into this. So I'm very excited about this. So welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you. Since we last spoke, how much of the book did you digest?
All of it.
you're very brave.
Yeah. It's been an interesting process while I've been going through the process. But before we get to the process, you made some really amazing points that I'd like to bring up before we even get into the process, where you make a whole bunch of amazing points. So let's talk about the first one, which is you talk about energy in motion, which is emotion. And it's when we start our infancy, which is, you know, to enter into the physical experience, we literally had to create an illusion of stopping the world, which is what we call time, which is that we've named our experiences, and we name something because it matters to us. So talk about how this all, I mean, it's almost like I have a cellular memory of this, and yet I know we probably shouldn't, but it's an interesting, true concept.
Well, the example that I sometimes give in presentations, which is funny to me, is that when we see a newborn child, if you watch the eyes of a newborn child and it watches the world is constantly moving to the child to the point, and absolutely fascinating because it's all energy in motion, to the point that you can hang a little thing over the crib that kind of goes round and round, and the child will look at it in awe for hours, you know, and be completely entertained because it's all this energy in motion. And then for some reason, you know, we go through this experience, and then we become adults when everything matters to us. It becomes solid and seemingly stationary. And then we develop these high-power microscopes to look at matter. And then we declare that if you look at matter really carefully, it's all moving. It's all energy and motion. So somewhere between being a child and a scientist in a high-power microscope, something happens. And we go through an experience of really... for me, what it is we enter the mental aspect of our experience. We see the world from primarily a mental realm. And it's a very different world to the one of energy and motion, is the one that we see as opposed to the one that is actually energetic.
Right. Wow. Yeah. And because you can, I mean, that's kind of, guess, what the Matrix movie was about, you know, really disconnecting from what we think is
right.
The world to what, you know, we experience, or the really being able to see that energy. And I think we've all had probably experiences where we have been able to see energy in motion.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's...
And, you know, another way, because these things, it's hard to describe these things to the mental body.
Yeah.
But metaphor, analogy is always useful. And the condition that we're in now, I know this from my own personal experience, from working with people and watching people move through their own process of integrating their imprinting, is if you go to if for example, you go to a show where you have a hypnotist in the show, and the hypnotist invites two people up from the audience and says to the one person, okay, I'm going to hypnotize you both, and when you look at her, you're going to see a teapot, and you want tea. You know, you're desperate for a cup of tea. And when you look at him, I'm going to hypnotize you, and you're going to see a jar of cookies, and all you want is cookies. You know, and once he hypnotizes them, they see each other as a teapot and a jar of cookies. And there is nothing that you can say to them to convince them otherwise. To them, that person really is a jar of cookies. And that's the one level that's very funny. But the other level of that, which is quite extraordinary, is while they're in that hypnotic state, they've completely forgotten that 5 minutes prior to being hypnotized, or to having that experience. They were actually sitting in chairs in the audience, and they have this entire lifetime, right? That entire awareness is gone. Mm. And so part of what happens is during our first 7 years, we become imprinted through our experiences. We first imprinted through feeling, and then we enter what I call the mental institution, or the institution that mentalizes us, which is our schooling system. And then we're imprinted mentally. And when we come outside, come through the other side of it, by the time we're adults, we literally are like those hypnotized people on stage. Mm-hmm. There's certain things we look at and we swear that that's what we're seeing. Not only that, but we have no memory of what was going on before the imprinting took place. And so part of the journey of the presence process is really to awaken us from the state of hypnosis, a state that's been passed from family to, you know, from generation to generation to generation.
Yeah. And let's talk about that 7-year cycle, because that's something else that you bring up in the beginning. And I just, it's very interesting concept to me, because, I mean, it's just so amazing that it's, you know, that we repeat the first 7 years, and maybe even the first, the last 7 months of our incubation while we're in our mother. But, you know, we repeat that first 7-year cycle over and over again. And this is why we keep saying, you know, why does this keep happening to me?
Right. And the repetition is not necessarily the physical events, although the physical events will have a theme to them. And the repetition is not necessarily the mental events, although the mental events will have a theme within them that is similar. What the repetition is the feeling aspect of the experience. Mm-hmm. So the feeling in the first 7 years of our life, we're not really functioning as mental beings, although we're developing some mental capacity towards the end of those 7 years. But we're functioning primarily as felt beings of felt perception. And when we encounter feelings that are deeply uncomfortable to us, that imprints the way that our feeling body works. And we then go to schooling, and that those feelings we then give names to. And then as we enter the adult world, those core feelings are then expressed as physical circumstances in our world that we gravitate towards because they're familiar to us. They're magnetized by our imprinting, and we develop certain physical symptoms to reflect this. But what's always important to remember is what's repeated every 7 years is the felt aspect of the experience. So, for example, I may get involved in a various number of relationships over my lifetime, and I may get involved with people that look physically different, and that on a mental level, it appears that I have a different kind of relationship to them, a different kind of experience with the different people. However, what causes me to want to leave that relationship and start a new one is I always arrive back at the same uncomfortable feeling that causes me to say, okay, this is not working, whatever. I'm arriving at the same feeling. And then what I do is I go out again and look for somebody else, and I re-manifest that feeling. And what I don't realize is that feeling attracts me like a magnet, because it's imprinted into me, you know, by the time I'm 7 years old. And unless I re-enter that level of awareness, the self-perception, and adjust that particular signature, I'm always going to use it as a point of reference. Unconsciously to me, it becomes a point of reference, and I navigate towards that. For example, a person who is abused as a child is magnetized as an adult towards abusive situations, even though men, on a very conscious level, they say, I won't go anywhere near abusive situations because, you know, I was abused as a child. However, if you watch their life, they will be attracted towards, they will attract abusive situations into their experience, because their definition of what love is will carry the felt resonance of abuse, because that's what's imprinted into the emotional body of the child. And that's the power of this first 7 years. And that's why I say liberation, true liberation, is emotional.
Mm-hmm. You make a great point here about often we embark on healing to change ourselves, but we cannot change ourselves, only the quality of our experience. When we mistakenly believe we are the experience we are having, then we attempt to restore balance by changing our behavior, our appearance, or our life circumstances. And this is drama.
Yes, yes. Well, that's the hypnotic state. You see, the hypnotic in the hypnotic state, you know, in the state in which I look at you and I see a jar of cookies and I just want a cookie, which is really what we're doing in relationships. Most of our relationships are built out of an uncomfortable emotional signature, and what they do is they maintain that emotional signature. Mm-hmm. So I look at someone and I think that I can get what I need and want from them, and that's why I'm in a relationship with them. But actually, it's the same as looking at a mirror and seeing pimples and saying, okay, let me get a cloth and clean the mirror, right? And so that's the state of hypnosis. The mirror is really our physical circumstances and our behaviors and those sorts of things, aspects of our experience. But they're all reflections of a causal point, which is an energetic place, which we encounter through feeling, through thought perception. So the physical and mental world are reflecting aspects of our experience. It was a conversation I was having with someone this morning, in which one of our cleaning the mirror to get rid of the pimples behavior is the belief that our genetics determines our behavior. Mm-hmm. In other words, we believe that our genes are determining our behavior and our experiences. But what we don't realize is that our genes is like a mirror. They're a reflection of our energetic of what our energetic situation is like. However the energetic imprinting takes place, that's the genes that we pass on. The genes are just reflecting it physically back to us. So it's not about changing our genes, it's about changing our energetic makeup. If someone goes in and does the work and transforms their energetic makeup that's imprinted into them, they really are changing their genetic situation, which is unthinkable in the medical world that a person can change their own genetic makeup. But actually, our genetic makeup is just mirroring our energetic imprinting.
Mm-hmm. Wow. All addiction is self-medication. All addiction is the experience that we are having. All experiences that we are having can be changed.
Yes.
And addiction, as you mentioned later, is... or self-medication is when we turn inwards to try and numb our discomfort or control it.
Right. Actually, addiction is when we kind of... There's two behaviors that are going on. Because when we're imprinted in the first 7 years of our life and we have these uncomfortable felt impressions planted into our emotional body, by the time from the age of 14... from the age of 7 to 14, when we go into our mental education, part of that is that our emotional body gets shut down, our emotional body awareness. We no longer really feel what's going on in the emotional body because our felt perception is shut down. We're then starting to perceive the world through a story and through physical circumstances. But what happens is within our emotional body, there are these patterns that have been passed on from generation to generation that are deeply uncomfortable to us. And so the way that we react to that is there's two, I call it the two-fisted punch. And most of us human beings are deeply involved in this behavior and don't even realize we're doing it. The one thing is we're sedating and controlling our authentic emotional experience. So we're sedating and controlling our fear, anger, and grief. And we can find many ways of doing that. Addiction is just one way. You know, we have pharmaceuticals. We have people do yoga, you know, six times a week to actually sedate and control their emotional discomfort.
Sure.
Anything we do that enables us to not feel what's going on, which can we can redefine as, you know, feeling okay, is a sedation and control. So on the one side, we're sedating and controlling and the authentic awareness of our emotional body. On the other hand, we're manipulating our circumstances to give a feeling to our experience that's not there, that we would rather be having. So we'll do something, I call that the behavior of trying to feel better. If you can help me to feel better, I will kind of like hanging around with you. If you can give me a medication that will enable me to feel better, then I'll probably take that medication. And this work is not about that, about feeling better. It's about getting better at feeling, which requires that we become first aware of our sedation and control behavior, and then aware of the behavior we're using to manipulate our emotional body into feeling a feeling we would rather be having, and we have to drop all that behavior so that the awareness of the emotional body can surface, and then we can work with that consciously. And that's what the presence process enables us to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just a few more before we actually delve into the presence process.
I love
this. When we speak of abundance, we mean money. When we speak of health, we mean our appearance. When we speak of joy, we mean happiness, which is conditional.
Yes. Well, you see, those definitions become redefined when we take our experience as valid. When we believe our experience is invalid, that we should be having another experience, we have a very different definition of joy, abundance, and health. Then joy is feeling happy or good. Abundance is having lots of money, and health is having a great appearance. And that's what happens when we're deeply uncomfortable and are trying to avoid that discomfort. But when we realize that my discomfort is valid, whatever's happening in my experience is valid, and I commit to integrating that, then joy is not feeling good. Joy is not really even an emotion. It's a relationship I have with my emotional body in which I allow myself to feel everything. And then abundance becomes the realization that the universe always gives me exactly what I require to grow. In other words, every time I get upset, that's a gift from the universe helping me to become aware of my emotional blockages. So the universe is extremely abundant when it comes to personal growth. It will give us whatever we require to grow, as many upsets as it takes for us to grow our emotional body and become aware we're emotionally blocked. And health is when not about my appearance. Health is when I take care of my emotional body and I pay attention to my emotional body and I take responsibility for the condition of my emotional body, for the felt aspect of my experience. In other words, for the quality of my experience. Mm-hmm. Because the quality of my experience, the bottom line is it's determined by how I feel about something. Mm-hmm. Determines the quality. So when I take responsibility for my own emotional body, I live as a healthy human being. Even though I may have symptoms that are uncomfortable, that I'm always taking the healthy approach to that. And when I open myself up to my experience as being valid and I receive everything as my teaching, then I open myself up to abundance. And when I allow myself to feel everything, I don't stop any feeling. I let all the feelings in to increase my feeling vocabulary. Then I'm really going to enter the frequency of what joy is about.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. Unconsciously, what we really need and want is for the big black hole in our hearts to be filled. Do we all have
this? Actually, you see, that's the deepest part of the work is we're like vampires. And what a vampire is a remarkable metaphor because it points to the human condition. You know, we say a vampire is afraid of the light. If they come into the light, they will die. You become a vampire by being bitten by another vampire. And what a vampire does is they get their food by biting on the neck sucking the blood of another person. Mm. And the way you kill a vampire is by putting a stake in the heart. And these are all metaphors of overcoming this vampiric human behavior. So being bitten and becoming a vampire, that's the imprinting. And what's imprinted is this belief that I need my sustenance from outside of me. In other words, if I come up to you and I say, oh, I've had such a hard day. And then you say, well, what happened? And I say, oh, well, this happened, and then that happened, and then that happened, and oh, it was so bad. And, and you sit and listen to me. And after a while, I feel better, and you feel terrible. And I've just had just a wonderful feast, and I walk off going, yum, yum, that was delicious, right? And what I've done is I've just emotionally got from you what I should be getting from giving to myself, right? And so what happens is what the darkness is the belief that I have to get my sustenance from someone else, from outside of myself. And so the stake in the heart is when I take all my awareness and I bring it to the heart center and I realize that my behavior comes out of imprinting and I go in there and I resolve that imprinting by allowing myself to feel my own fear, anger, and grief, which means I'm going to have to comfort myself as I go through those experiences. I will develop the capacity to give myself emotionally what I've been seeking from others, and in that light, the vampire will die, right? And that behavior of running to others to get... So that the only way that we can fill that hole within us is when we give to ourselves what we have been seeking, what we've been expecting other people to give us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much on an emotional level.
And you know, can I... there's a whole process, though, before you can get to that place, which we're going to...
Well, it's not even a getting to a place. It's really entering a way of being because, you know, there isn't a point at which I'm not going to be responsible for my own heart. And I'm not going to be required to hold myself and comfort myself in times when I feel alone or times when I feel sad or times, you know, these times come to us like tidal, like waves, like tides. And the thing is not to arrive at a destination of being constantly happy. That is the mental body's version of enlightenment. It's about entering a journey in which in any given moment when it's required, I can respond to what's happening, you know, by giving myself emotionally what I require to continue to grow.
Right. Okay. We ask for change. We are given the opportunity to change. We embrace the opportunity. We start feeling different. The mind tells us that this feeling is wrong. We become afraid. We turn against that which is changing our experience. We return to what is familiar and safe. Nothing is accomplished. We feel more frustrated and disillusioned than before. The mind has grown stronger, and we have become weaker.
Yes. You know, it's that adage. You got to think. You know, there's a saying: think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if thinking is the box? Right. So what happens is we want transformation as long as nothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very difficult situation because, you know, and in fact, I was contemplating this morning because, you know, I realize how challenging it is for us to make the shift. For example, I was, you know, saying a few moments ago that all our relationships, if we fall in love with someone and have a powerful, passionate attraction to somebody, it's called falling in love, and the emphasis is actually on falling.
Mm-hmm.
And although it's a powerful experience, because it's such a powerful jolt, you can be sure it's drawing off our emotional charge that was imprinted into us as a child. So that relationship is going to become a structure that's built out of our emotional signature. So now I say I want to change, I want to emotionally grow up. So I start doing emotional work. If I start to do emotional work and I start to integrate the imprints of my emotional body, what's going to happen is the structures I've built around myself outside as a consequence of those imprints are going to fall apart. So you'll find people say, oh, I want to do the intimacy work as long as I don't lose my companion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a big leap. You know, it's such a big leap we have to make it out of our hypnosis. And what I was contemplating this morning, it's so big that you know, for a Christian, the box they're in is Christianity.
Mm.
And for a Muslim, the box they're in is their belief system as a Muslim. And for a Jew, the box they're in is Judaism, right? And so can a Christian really get out of the box of being a Christian? Or do they not really want to change? They just want a different form of Christianity. In other words, can I really get out of the paradigm of the relationship I'm in? Or do I just want a different paradigm of the same box? Right? So our getting out of the box we're in that's made out of our emotional signature is an immense task and mustn't be underestimated by anyone. I mean, I've seen for myself, you know, going on this, what I call this hiatus, or as you were saying at the beginning of the program, I'm leaving. You know, the presence process and all the work that's come, the presentations, everything has come out of my fear, anger, and grief, right? Mm-hmm. It came out of that. And for me, now I've done that work to a certain level, I want to climb out of that box, so I had to walk away from doing this work.
Mm.
You see, how much are we prepared to get out of the box we're in? Even if it's a beautiful box, do we really want the freedom from the emotional signature? Which means that wherever we are, we're in some sort of box. And that's what we're frightened of doing. We're really frightened of climbing out of the box. It's like that story of a parrot that lives in a cage for 10 years. And if you open the cage door, it won't leave because the cage is its home.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the same thing with a prisoner who's been in prison for 60 years. Many prisoners that are released after many years of incarceration leave prison, and they purposely commit a crime so that they're put back in prison because they can't live outside of the box. And as human beings, we're in the same situation. We're addicted to what's familiar and known to us. And change means I'm going to enter an experience that is unknown and unfamiliar. And so it's very much, and that's why we have a presence process to sort of support us as we go through this journey.
Right. Okay, well, let's go into session one where we talk about breathing. Now, with the first interview we did, breathing was a part of the book, and I didn't really bring it up. And I'm glad we didn't, because this is really the process that the breathing becomes really important. And it's rather radical, because there are certainly a lot of Eastern philosophies out there that would, you know, give you very different breathing techniques to learn and become present, or to become enlightened, or to meditate, or whatever. And I know that I've learned quite a few, you know, with Tantra. And so there are different processes and different ways of breathing. And so yours is very simple, and it's about consciously connected breathing.
Right. You know, any breathing technique manifests according to its intent. So if it really works, then it has manifested out of an intent. And so when you're doing yoga, the intent is to support the yoga practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so the breathing in yoga will be different to, for example, pranayama. Pranayama breathing has come out of an intent to support its practice. You know, what is the intent of its practice is, which may be, you know, to have some sort of spiritual experience or to get control over certain aspects of our physical being. So really, each breathing technique that is in the world that has been going on and on because it works is there because it supports its intent. So it's very important to be clear on what the intent is when we enter any breathing practice, because each intent has a different outcome. The intent of the breathing practice in the presence process is not for us to have a spiritual experience. You know, the intent is to assist us to become aware of the authentic condition of our emotional body and to enable us to have the capacity to begin integrating that. In other words, to bring presence to our emotional condition. And the way it works is very simple. We just connect our in-breath and our out-breath, breathing fairly normally, slightly more intensely than a normal breathing, but the focus of the breath is that the in-breath and the out-breath are connected, and we breathe in and out. And in order to breathe that way, consciously connecting our breathing, because most human beings don't breathe, we're pausing all the time, and we're pausing because we're going into the mental plane and we're not ready in the moment. The consciously connected breathing holds us. In order to consciously connect my breathing, an aspect of my awareness has to stay absolutely present in the moment. And when I hold an aspect of my awareness present in the moment, I am going to trigger an awareness of where it is I am unable to be present. It's going to come in my awareness either as a physical experience or as mental stuff going on. And finally, when I hold myself in that place consistently every day, it's going to come up as the causal point of why I cannot be present, which is, in other words, the emotional discomfort underlying all my physical and mental experiences. And the intent is to bring that awareness to the surface so that I can start to consciously integrate it. Once we've accomplished that with the breathing, then the breathing falls away. So it's not a lifetime practice. Mm-hmm. It really is a practice simply to support an gaining an awareness of what's going on in the emotional body, because we have to be aware that for most of us, we've spent most of our life becoming masters at sedating and controlling an awareness of what's going on with us emotionally. So we need a little assistance to regain that awareness, and the breathing serves as that.
Beautiful. So sessions 2, 3, 4, and 5 are all about the emotional cleansing process. Session
yes.
2 is identifying the messenger, and I think this is a really great way of talking about, you know, the person that is our mirror or our teacher. I think
yes.
it really gives it a more neutral position.
Right, right. It takes us out of victim and victim mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we look at session 2, 3, 4, and 5, all the way to 6 actually, we spend the first 6 sessions of the book trying to break the state of hypnosis. And the state of hypnosis leads us to believe that the mirror, you know, that the pimples in the mirror can only be removed by cleaning the mirror. In other words, if I'm upset with somebody, the only way I can resolve it is by physically making them behave differently or by mentally trying to reason with them, because I perceive that my upset, the causal point of my upset is coming from them. That's the state of hypnosis. Whenever we are upset, and there is no exception to the rule, it's because a memory of our imprinting is being surfaced, is surfacing, and it's being triggered either by a physical circumstance or by mental processes that are coming out of physical circumstances. So, you know, session 2 is saying, identify the messenger. And the messenger is the point that's causing the triggering. It can be a physical circumstance. It can be a physical symptom we're going through. It can be someone's behavior. And so to identify the messenger and say, look, this is the mirror, right? And then session 3, we're saying, look, okay, now you've identified the messenger or the mirror. Now you need to get the message. The messenger is usually always something physical. It's a physical aspect of our experience. And then we need to get the message. The message is mental. In other words, the message is basically going to be, I'm angry, I'm afraid, or I'm sad. Otherwise, I wouldn't be upset. I'm either going to be one of those three. And then the session 4 is then going to be moving towards the causal point, the emotional aspect, and say, where am I feeling this in myself? I'm going to be feeling this somewhere, this fear, anger, or grief in my body. And as we approach session 6, we're now learning that this felt aspect or this discomfort is actually a child part of ourselves. In other words, when we say it's the child part of our being is the first 7 years of our development. And those first 7 years are our emotional development. And until we work with our emotional body directly, it is like a child, especially it's like a child without a parent. It's a child that is angry or afraid or sad. And so really what we're saying when we're doing inner child work is that we're going to our emotional content and we are now going to become the parent to that emotional content so that it can grow. And the first thing is to accept it unconditionally and say, yes, I know you're angry. Yes, I know you're sad. Yes, I know you're afraid, and I'm going to be with you through that. And that will enable ourselves to take the conditions or the sedation and controlling off of that and allow that experience to surface into our awareness and start moving to a point of resolution. And we spend the first, you know, 6 sessions of the process teaching ourselves how to do that. And really what we are accomplishing is enabling us to perceive what a memory really is. Mm-hmm. So when I'm getting upset, what's happening is a memory is surfacing. Whenever I get upset, the memory can be reflected off the physical world. It can be analyzed or analyzed with my anal eyes by thinking about it and telling stories about it or describing it or trying to understand it. But the real memory itself is the felt aspect of the experience, which we can describe as fear, anger, and grief, and we don't even have to describe it, but we will because we're such mental beings, but it's the felt aspect of the experience. Once we can engage directly with the felt aspect of the experience, we're now at the causal point.
Do you want to talk about reaction versus response?
Well, reaction is when I project, when a memory comes up and I do something physically or mentally to try and sedate and control my awareness of it. So, for example, if you and I have an argument, a reaction would be me saying, no, listen, this is what you need to do about your behavior, because if you change your behavior, I'm going to feel better, right? So I will force you to somehow, or I'm leaving you. Sorry, I can't be with you anymore, and I physically move away, or I tell you to go away. So I try and do something physically, or I try and do something mentally. So, you know, let's have a talk, right? So if I say to you, let's have a talk, I'm in reaction mode. I'm in a state of delusion because I believe talking can somehow adjust my causal point. And what I'm trying to say to you is, I want you to admit that I'm right. If you admit that I am right, then I'm going to feel better about what's going on here and we can be at peace. But if you don't admit that I am right, we have a problem, right? So that's a reactive behavior, is when we do anything mentally or physically to try and adjust the quality of the experience we're having. Responsive behavior is when I use the upsetting experience. Say you and I have a disagreement and I feel upset and I say, okay, this is not an upset, this is a setup. And it's a setup to see something about me that's blocked. I'm going to respond to this by going to the causal point. So it doesn't have anything to do with you. Yes, it appears because you're the mirror. It appears like you're the cause of it. I'm not going to try and physically change what you're doing. I'm not even going to reason with you mentally. I'm actually not even going to believe the story about what's going on. What I'm going to do is ask myself, what am I feeling right now? I'm feeling fear, anger, and grief. Where am I feeling this in my body? I'm going to place my awareness on that, and I'm going to be with that without condition, because actually what's really going on when I get upset is I'm becoming aware of myself as a 7-year-old or younger that is in deep discomfort, and it's asking for the parents to come and love it. And love is actually, we call it unconditional love or being without condition. If I go to that part of myself and I respond to it by saying, yes, I'm angry now and that's valid, and I'm going to be with my anger. I'm not going to go into the story. I'm not going to project it into physical behavior. I'm just going to be with the anger. That anger will go through an energetic movement that will bring it to a point of resolution. That is a response, because a response is going to adjust the causal point. A reaction is simply going to cover my awareness up of the causal point.
And talk again about drama and self-medication.
Well, all drama is the behavior that I'm using to sedate and control the awareness of the causal point of my experience. So we can have all sorts of drama. We can have, sickness. And then we can respond to that sickness by doing physical things to ourselves and trying to change the way we think. We can have arguments with people. We can go and make war in other countries. There's many ways that we can explore drama. Drama is an externalization of my discomfort upon the world, a projection of it through my behavior. And actually, that projection is also sedating and controlling my awareness of the causal point, because it's sending my attention out into the world as opposed to into myself. And so drama is a type of self-medication. And what this work is about stopping drama as our way of interacting with the world, and rather seeing the Dharma. So we either have a choice between drama, which is reactive behavior, and Dharma, which is responding to it. And the Dharma is when I go into the causal point, I allow myself to feel it at the causal point, and I will receive insight. Once I get to a point of resolution, I will receive insight about what that was about. And to me, that's the Dharma. That will be the teaching out of the... And that will teach me how to manage my life in a more responsible way, how to engage with people in a more responsible and mature way, and how to be useful and of service in the world to others instead of resorting to Dharma whenever, I mean, to drama when anything happens.
Mm-hmm. I think what I also liked about when you discussed drama in session six was that, you know, it was really, it's our first consequence to the negative emotional charge, and it was what we used to get attention and acceptance from others,
yes,
because we're just all looking for unconditional love.
Yes. Yes, well, you know, it's that thing of trying to fill the hole.
Right.
Anything we use of this world, whether it's people or stuff, to try and fill the hole that can only be filled by the loving attention we pay to ourselves can be defined as drama. Mm. So drama can be buying a brand new car so I feel better about myself. Drama can be manifesting a sickness so that I go to hospital so that people come and visit me and bring me sweets and flowers because I don't know how to give that to myself. Drama can be having a loud fight in the restaurant so I get everyone's attention. There are many ways that I can bring up drama to receive. Drama is, again, the vampiric behavior, an attempt to get from the world what it is I should be able to give to myself.
Yeah.
And so this work is about emotionally growing up, about developing the capacity to give myself emotionally what it is I've been seeking from others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quick and easy, you know, and it's really an organic journey. So once we choose the journey, we're on the ride, we're on the trip. You know, once you get on the roller coaster, you can't decide as it's sort of moving up the hill that you want to get off. You're strapped in and you're in for the ride, and there's going to be some ups and downs and some shrieks and some fear and all sorts of stuff, some nausea. But when you get to the other side, you'll be exhilarated at having taken the ride. And it's the same thing as the journey through the emotional body. It very much is like a roller coaster, and that's why it's useful to have a procedure. A procedure is like that metal bar that they put over you in a roller coaster that keeps you from jumping up, you know? and gives you a sense that you are safe, even though you're going into a place that you would never in your wildest dreams have thought that you had the courage to enter, which is our own fear, anger, and grief.
Mm-hmm.
We and that's what also... you know, what this work is a self-limiting, and not that it limits anything, but if we're not ready to enter this work, we pick up the presence process and we're not ready to enter a certain level of the work, we would stop at that point. In other words, some people will read the book until session one and then they'll put the book down and say, no, I'm not ready for this. Other people will do the process right up to session six. And when they get to session seven, they'll put the work down. Because session seven, eight, and nine is when session seven is about our fear, session seven is eight is about our anger, and session nine is about our grief. So if we're not really ready yet to go into that, then we'll automatically put the book down and pick it up again when we're ready to take on that part of the journey.
Well, let's talk about session seven, because I found it, I had to experience it because I wanted to be able to have an experience while I did the interview. But so I went into the water, and what I really realized was, you know, you talk about the heat build up and it being an ongoing resistance to the emotional authentic, the negative emotional charge that we have and how it creates heat within our body and resistance. And so I have had, you know, very firsthand experience of what that feels like now, and I'm becoming much more aware of what that feels like. And, you know, initially my neck went into spasm, and so I've had a lot of interesting things happen. So it is a very powerful thing to, you know, do this water aspect.
Yes, although it's a very simple, you see, the thing about the water session is that it's supported by the first 6 weeks of the process and all the training one goes through. You see, let the listener know that the first third of the book almost is a training manual, and it trains us before we even enter session one, because this work is about self-facilitation. And what we're going to learn is a vocabulary through which we may communicate with our experience. In other words, once we enter session one, we are going to have experiences that are not familiar or known to us. And what happens is by the time we've reached session one, whether we realize it or not, we've trained ourselves with a vocabulary. So when we have those experiences, we're able to comfort ourselves and encourage ourselves and keep on track because we can explain to ourselves what's going on in a territory in which would normally we would require somebody else. Mm-hmm. So this teaches us how to do it. And as we're going from session one to six, we're again preparing ourselves to enter the emotional realm. And that's why from session one to six, we're actually opening up the pathway of awareness. When we enter the world, as we were saying earlier on in the seven-year cycle, our first 7 years are emotional. Our next 7 years are primarily mental as we go through schooling. And then we go through puberty and we enter a very physical adult experience. So the pathway of awareness is going from the emotional of childhood through the mental of the teenage years and into the physical of the adult. As we go from session one to six, we're reversing that pathway because we're looking at the messenger, which is very physical. Then we're looking at the message, which is mental. And then we're getting into feeling that, which is getting into the emotional. What we're doing is we're opening up that pathway of awareness back into our emotional body. Once that pathway of awareness is open, we're now going to be vulnerable to the authentic condition of our emotional body. And we trigger that awareness by going into water, which is the element of emotion. The water is warm, it's not hot. And we sit in that water and we just allow ourselves to be there. And because of the intent of the book and the work and the presence activation statements, they all come together to trigger an awareness of what's going on in our emotional body in a physical, mental, or emotional way as we're doing those water sessions. And they bring up an awareness of the heat in the emotional body. And what the heat is anywhere in our emotional body that we are in resistance. For example, when we're imprinted as a child, imprinting is when we have an experience that is deeply uncomfortable to us because we're in a stage of felt perception as a child. And the way we respond to that is we react by resisting that. And that resistance impacts the way our emotional body is structured or runs. Any form of resistance, if you rub your hands together and you resist the rubbing and you press your hands together, it creates a friction, which then creates a heat. And that's going on in our emotional body all the time. That's why we say, oh, he's hot under the collar, or he's going to blow off some steam, or he's going to blow off his top. We have this in our language that there's heat and there's somehow steam and liquid involved. And that's because we're talking metaphorically about the conditions of our own emotional body. And so that, as that condition comes to our awareness, it may come up as physical conditions, like your neck. You are figuring out what's a pain in the neck to you, right, in your life, right? Or it will come up as mental stories and tales we tell ourselves, or it will come up directly as emotional experiences that we relate to as fear, anger, and grief. And so in session seven, we're looking at the causal points of our fear. What are the things that caused us to run away from our body and live in the mental world? And those are the causes of our fear.
And right? And you mean literally, because you're saying that, you know, fear causes the evacuation of the physical body. So we literally...
Yeah, literally, most of us do not live in the body, although we perceive this body tagging around with us wherever we go. But, you know, a person can drive, you know, I can have an engagement somewhere, for example, and I drive there. And especially if it's a place that I go regularly, like if I'm driving to work every day, people who drive to work every day completely leave their physical reality and go into their mental. And they, you'll see that you get to work and you don't even remember the journey there because you were in the mental realm the whole time, having discussions, conversations, planning the future, arguing about the past. And suddenly you arrive at work and you have no recollection of how you arrived there because we haven't been in the body. Often the only time we come into the body is when, you know, is if we get a fright or, you know, someone, you know, shows up to talk to us and we have to arrive back out of the mental plane or something. So part of the journey is to re-enter the physical body. And as a child, we kind of started exiting the physical body through our imprinting. And one of the places we went to was the mental realm, the story. So most of us live in a story. Everything to us is a story. And that's why the world doesn't look to us like energy and motion anymore. It looks to us like an unfolding, very physicalized story that we're telling that matters to us. A story that matters is what we can say it is.
Mm-hmm. And then you give us two tools, which is attention and intention.
Yes.
And I think
the attention is really the tool of the mental body. It's like, where's my point of focus in any given moment? My experience is made up of, in any given moment, my experience is the accumulation of my attention and my intention. And the intention actually drives the attention. Although when we don't have emotional body awareness, we don't realize it. In other words, the condition of the child, the emotional body, is driving the quality of the experience of the adult because it's causing the adult to put its attention in certain places. So, for example, some adults only attend to making money. All their attention is on making money. And if you really sat with that adult, you'd find that as a child, they didn't feel worthy on some level or they went without on some level deeply. And so their intention is to never have that experience of lack again or to make up for it or whatever the intention is, and it drives them as an adult to attend only to money. So the intention, which is the child part, is driving the attention, which is what our mental body is thinking about and therefore as, where we're focusing in the physical world. And what this work is about taking responsibility for our attention, I mean our intention. The moment I take responsibility for my intention, in other words, my emotional, my child self, then I consciously drive my attention. Otherwise, my attention is moved around reactively through trying to satisfy all my wants and my unresolved needs and wants, as opposed to moving towards what I require as a being to grow.
Session 8. Which is about forgiveness.
Yes. So session 8 is about anger. And, you know, there is only self-forgiveness. There is no of forgiving others. Forgiving others is a radiance of forgiving oneself. And so the self-forgiveness, you know, when I look, for example, in my own life, right, if I look at my behaviors prior to entering this work. You know, I did some really weird and wacky things. I did a lot of things that were destructive to myself and consequently were destructive to other people. I told many horrible stories about other people. I told many horrible stories about myself. You know, so there are many things that I did that were, you can think of, self-destructive and destructive towards others. But then I did this emotional work. And what I discovered is that this behavior was coming out of an imprint that I received in the first 7 years of my life, an imprint that was passed on by my parents and my family, passed on to them by their parents and their family for generations and generations. So then I go in there and then I start to become aware of this imprint and I integrate it. In other words, I unplug the causal points of these destructive behaviors. And then I no longer enter these destructive behaviors. Now I can look at myself and say, wow, that was the causal point of my destructive behavior. I went in and did the work. I'm no longer involved in this behavior. What is there not to forgive myself about, right? Mm-hmm. I can now forgive myself for all those things because I've responded to it. And in fact, I've grown because of it. So therefore, if I can forgive myself, and I know that every single human being is in the same predicament. They're all imprinted through their generations. They're all involved in unconscious behavior arising out of these imprints. How can I hold them and judge them? And of course, one doesn't want to be the victim of someone else's imprint. One has to be discerning about that. But the fact is, if I'm imprinted and can overcome it, and I can see that my destructive behavior came out of my imprint, and I can forgive myself, that forgiving of myself is an automatic forgiving of the world because we're all in the same boat.
And you also talk about figuring out your primary definition of love, which is always unconscious.
That's going to be session 9.
Oh, is that right. Session 9?
Yeah, session 9, we're going to go and look at our unconscious definition of love,
okay. Which
is really the causal point of our grief.
Mm. It's the opposite one that's hard to figure out, but
it's very challenging to figure out because it's not an understanding. And you see, in the book, we try and bring it to us as an understanding because the book is a mental communication of an energetic process, right?
Mm.
So we have to communicate to us mentally because that's where we are in the world. That's how we're communicating at the moment. So what the unconscious definition of love, it's very simple. Whatever the sum of the self-impressions I receive as a child, whatever the sum of those impressions are, becomes my definition of love by the time I'm 7. By the time I'm 7 years old, I already have my definition of love installed. As an adult, I may have another definition of love, like I may say, love is wine and roses and, you know, being happy with people. But, you know, love is unconditional and all these things we tell ourselves. But the moment I meet someone that I'm attracted to, what will happen is as time passes with that person, I will manipulate the experience so that my unconscious definition of love surfaces. Because really that's my child's definition of love. And so that's the case of if I'm abused as a child, I will enter a relationship with the intent of being loving to the other person. But at some point, abusive behavior will arise because I won't truly feel love until I experience some level of abuse. Because my definition of love is the felt aspect that arises when there's abuse. And so the work is to go and realize what that unconscious definition of love is and really implant a conscious definition of love, which we implant by being with ourselves without condition. If I'm able to be with myself without condition, as an example, that part of my being, that child part, receives an example of what love really is, and then it will gravitate to that in the world and manifest that in the world. But it's one of our deepest things is to see what our unconscious definition of love is.
It's true, and it's an interesting process. And I think I really got it when I went home for the weekend one weekend, because it was asking, you know, how do I share this with my family? And I guess I thought I had worked through so much of this with my family that I wasn't really picking up anything as to, you know, well, where did I get this from my family, until I went home and then miraculously it all appeared.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be served out on a silver platter.
A silver platter for sure.
Our family, any process that excludes our family, in other words, it's not that we have to invite our family into the process, but if our work does not impact the way we relate to our family and bring it into a state of peaceful relating, then we're not really impacting the causal point. Mm-hmm. And the nature of our family is our family are ascended masters at button pushing, because they know where all our buttons are and they know how to reflect what's going on truly inside of us. And anywhere our family upset us is to do with our own inner emotional condition. And what we normally do is go and try and change our family or reason with them or physically move away from them and have nothing to do with them, and not realizing that each one of our family is a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mirroring things to us, but we're supposed to do the alchemy and that go internally and make the adjustment at the felt aspect, the causal point. When we do that aspect of the work, we transform the entire way that we relate to our family.
Mm-hmm. I also liked how you talked about it in identifying the messenger. The question was, well, how does this happen? And the response is that our inner presence is intimately connected with the presence of everyone else. So that's
Absolutely. Really
what it's all about.
Absolutely. That's why the entire universe knows when you commit to emotional processing. If I commit to emotional processing, every tree, flower, human being, everything knows, because the inner presence within me is the inner presence in everything else. And so it has an ability, and because we don't have insight, you know, our emotional body is shut down. We don't even know what our blocked things are. So what it does is the world brings us an awareness of that by putting on a film or a movie outside of us. It'll get people to behave around us in the strangest ways that cause us to be upset. And what it's really happening is it's helping us to trigger an awareness of the deeply suppressed fear, anger, and grief. And so once we commit to doing this work, the universe says, okay, well, let's bring it on then, right? Mm-hmm. And then it'll bring us, it'll find any opportunity, especially, that's what I call the thief in the night. I shall come as a thief in the night. And what that means is that the thief in the night is the upset that awakens us out of our illusion that everything is okay, because we've suppressed and sedated everything and now we're fast asleep. Mm-hmm. And the thief in the night is the upset, that the Christ is actually the crisis. And when we respond to that, that's when we develop the capacity to again enter the kingdom. You know, unless we become as a child again, we don't enter the kingdom. Unless we go in and take care of those first 7 years and integrate that, we don't enter the kingdom. We live in the boredom. And so, you know, the work is very much about moving from the boredom, from the time-based paradigm into the kingdom, into being with the moment as it is and celebrating the moment to be valid and to be our truth.
Right. And then we have to figure out what the opposite of our unconscious definition of love is, which is really tricky, but it did help when I went home for that weekend.
Yes, no, the family is just very useful and helpful.
Yeah, really helpful.
Not normally the help we seek.
No, it wasn't a good conversation where we sat and said, so, this is my really unconscious definition. What do you think the opposite would be? Yeah, no, it came from a good release of anger.
Yes. Yeah, but you see, we don't have to even engage our family at all. We just have to pay attention to them. And they will bring up all the fear, anger, and grief, because the same way as we share an inner presence, we all share upon the planet the same inner presence. Mm-hmm. We also, in our family, we share the same emotional imprint. And so our family just reflects to us different aspects of the emotional imprint that's already within us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the father reflects where we don't have an ability to guide ourselves. The mother reflects our nurturing capacity. The sister reflects our capacity to heal ourselves and take responsibility for our experience. And the brother reflects our capacity to take our own life to be our teaching. And if anywhere of those places are out of balance, we will be in dissonance with one of those archetypes, one or more of them.
Hmm. Oh, that's good. I liked how it ended about giving is receiving. And I also liked the fact that you talked about how most people take, or most people get, they're wanting to get something and they're not really focused on giving. And so therefore they cannot receive. And of course, the first way to do this is to unconditionally give to self and then to others.
Right. You know, it's really about, you know, this is really important. The most important question we can ask at the moment as human beings with the state of our planet and the state of our species is, what do we require? And what is the difference between what we require and what we want? Because if we cannot, you know, what we want is driven by our own emotional signature imprinted from generation to generation. What we require is what we require to grow as beings, as a species. And they're two very different things. And once we answer the question, what do we require, we have to be able to develop the capacity to receive that. And what we want is what we get from the world, and we're literally raping this planet to get what we want. Mm-hmm. And yet the planet has everything we require already if we can just receive it. The state of being in want is a state of hypnosis. It's believing in, you know, the person is a cookie jar or a teapot. And believing that this planet is just, you know, an oil bank for us to deplete, because that'll give us everything we want. But actually, what do we really require as a species? And what do we really require individually to grow in the world? And we don't even have to answer that question. Mm-hmm. We just have to ask, what do we require? And the universe around us will begin to show us what we require. And it will have nothing to do with what we think we need or want.
And session 10, living on purpose, the universal law of cause and effect.
Yeah. Well, you know, living on purpose really is living in a state of response. That's really all it is. It's about taking every moment as being valid. And if anything is knocking me or making me deeply uncomfortable, is by responding to that and going to the causal point of that. And staying at the causal point as much as possible at the feeling center. If I stay at the feeling center of what is going on, I stay out of the story and I don't believe the story and enter the behaviors that come out of the story, if I stay at the feeling center, I'm less likely to interfere or to interfere, and I will stay on purpose with my life. You know, my life's purpose is being revealed in each moment if I can accept the moment as valid. If I don't accept the moment as valid, I'm going to go off purpose. I'm going to look for a purpose given to me by somebody else or by some other, you know, by some other philosophy. But actually, my purpose is being revealed to me in each moment through the experience of the moment. So it's really about staying in the moment as much as possible, accepting it as valid. If I get upset or things are uncomfortable, that's valid. That's the purpose for the moment. Can I respond to that rather than react to it?
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the world is a gap, and that's how we've separated ourselves from the oneness that we all really can be, and the energy and motion that if we could get back there, we could see. And I think that's, you know, a really brilliant way of talking about how we've just separated our experiences and separated ourselves.
Yeah, we've become obsessed by, you know, the world is what unfolds between us. And so, you know, the example I give in the book is about, you know, paying for your groceries. And either we're focused on the stuff we're paying for and the cost of the groceries and the stories about that, or we're aware of the presence in front of us that is ringing up, you know, the cashier. Mm-hmm. Are we really, because this life is about being with each other, about being with each other. And all the stuff is to facilitate that. It's a means to that end. And if we truly be with each other, you know, we enter the kingdom. But if we are doing with the stuff, you know, we're either being with each other or doing with the stuff. If my focus is on the stuff and I lose sight of the presence in front of me, because literally the distance between me and the cashier in any given moment when I'm ringing up my groceries is really the distance between me and God. And when I'm involved in the stuff, the more infatuated I am with the stuff of the world to get what I want, the greater the distance is between me and another, the greater distance between me and what God is. God is the presence in all of us. And when I connect with that person in front of me when I'm ringing up my groceries and I actually connect with them on a level that they're at and I'm at, and I say, how are you? You know, how's your week going? How's your day going? How much longer do you have on shift? You know, and actually pay some sort of level of interest to their life and connect with them, we will see that the presence in them will awake and their eyes lighten up and they come into our space too. We bring the presence out of them. And suddenly the experience of, you know, paying our groceries becomes an experience of presence as opposed to just another experience of getting things done. When we live in a world of just getting things done and doing stuff, that's the world of the boredom. When each encounter we have with a human being is an opportunity to resonate with presence, then we are entering a level of communion, which is when we're entering the kingdom. You know, when we recognize that that person is really me in a different form. Mm-hmm. Right.
And I love this part because I think it's also the fact that we're talking about living on purpose. But because we were not unconditionally loved for who we are, we began attempting to figure out what we had to do to be deserving of this unconditional love. And I think that's why, you know, we come up with all of these things that give us purpose, and that's not the point.
Yes. You know, also while we hit this point, I would love to encourage your listeners to go onto the website, the Presence Portal, and to experience the one-on-one session on the audio page, because it will give them a deeper insight into what we're talking about here, how we've entered doing as a means to compensate for a lack of awareness of being or the lack of value placed in our being in the world. For starters, we have to place our own value upon our being. We have to value that ourselves. And as I value my own beingness, I will value that in everybody else. But as a child, when we come in, our beingness isn't really valued because we're in a world of doers who do stuff. And what is valued is what you do here. What are you going to do? And we even say to people, how do you do? You know, one of the first questions we ask people is, so what do you do? We have no interest in being whatsoever, in the resonance of being. It's completely invisible to us now. But everything, it's the causal point of everything. Mm-hmm. And so the journey from the boredom back to the kingdom is the journey from doing as a means to accomplish causal adjustment to our experience to being without condition as a means to adjust, you know, is to make an adjustment to the causal point of our experience.
And I guess we'll end it with appreciation and gratitude, because I think, you know, and I know that you talk about if you've never really felt gratitude, but it really shifts your entire energy when you can think about, even when you're in a place of pain, and you can think about the gratitude that a relationship gave you, or the gratitude, you know, what you feel appreciative of someone that you're, you know, you're very upset with. And it can shift your entire energy when you can get into a place of gratitude.
Yes, and when we work with our experience, when we respond to our experience by going to the causal point of the emotional signature and making that adjustment, and then that'll bring us to the realization, when we make that adjustment and see the consequences of that on our life, we will realize every experience, whether comfortable or uncomfortable, is a gift for our growth. And out of that comes the authentic gratitude. Not a gratitude because I have something and you don't, or because I've accomplished something and you haven't. The gratitude comes out of the abundance of the universe, the abundance to provide to me what I, if I require in each moment for my growth. And then even when I am uncomfortable, I know intrinsically that this is part of my growth, because I know how to respond to it and gain the insight and the dharma out of it, and the emotional growth out of it. And there the gratitude comes out of that knowing, but it comes out of experientially having that, you know, part of my life, not out of understanding this, but entering the experience.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And that's the book. But is there anything else that you'd like to mention before you, you know, direct people back to your website again? But is there anything else that I've missed? You know, I was going to joke with you about the Into the Water, and that was probably why you had shaved your head during that period or for this book.
No, actually, I shaved my head. Funnily enough, we were speaking about this the other day. I used to have very long hair, and I had it all my life. And a woman who was had a profound impact on me when I was 18, who told me I would do all this work and write these books, she also said to me, never cut your hair. You cut your hair, you will lose all your power. Oh. And one day I went, hang on a moment, that's a trick thing. So I went and I shaved my head, and I my ego just fell to pieces, because my entire appearance had been about having this long hair. Mm. And suddenly I realized what the ego was and how it really works with appearance. And it liberated me. And for the first time in my life, I actually was able to ground myself and gain my power. In fact, the opposite happened. It was like, you know, the oracle telling Neo that he wasn't the one in the Matrix, right? Mm. It was the same sort of thing. So that's why I shaved my head. And so that's where that comes from, which I don't know how we even got into that point.
Sorry.
But really, really, the only thing I want to tell people is that your experience is absolutely valid. Whatever experience you're having now is your truth. It's your pathway into your liberation, and learning how to read that experience and communicate directly with it in a way that you respond to it is the most important thing you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people can get information on you from both Namaste Publishing and the Presence Portal. Is that correct?
Yeah, the Presence Portal is an entire, you know, fun fair of video clips and audio clips and articles. And all of these support the books, The Presence Process and the book Alchemy of the Heart. Mm-hmm. There's also a book that supports The Presence Process. They all support this journey of emotional liberation. And the emotional liberation leads into the vibrational awareness while we're in this world. And all this supports that in a way that you can do it for yourself, with yourself, within your life experience, wherever you are, wherever you are planted right now. You don't have to leave it or join a path. Or everything is given to you if you just know how to read it and respond to it.
Well, very nice. Well, Michael, I thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to interview you. It did go a little over. I hope you don't mind, but it's
That's
been
quite all right. I wasn't going anywhere.
Okay, good.
And I appreciate your interest in the work and actually going in and, you know, having an in-depth look at this work, because it really makes for such a better conversation for your listeners. When, you know, I really appreciate you're taking the time to do that.
Well, I can't say that it was an easy thing. Like, it really, when you said it was a manual, I mean, it really is a manual. It's
well, you know, the word easy is overrated, right?
Very. But it well worth it. It's very, very well worth it. Definitely.
Well, thank you. I'm always appreciative of anyone who goes in and does the work. To me, that touches my heart when anyone goes in and does the work for themselves, because I know that they're going to bless every human being around them by transforming their own experience.
All right. Well,
all right.
I can't wait for when you come back to see what new and exciting things are going to be in store, and maybe we'll have you back soon.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I've really enjoyed this. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.